We are in Genesis chapter 18, ready for verse number 9. Very exciting story here. This is the story that is the basis of a command in the book of Hebrews that we should always show hospitality to strangers, that is, care about strangers as they come into our sphere of influence, because those of the past have entertained angels without knowing it. And so here is Abraham, who has been entertaining, without realizing it, a couple of angels of God and God himself. These three strangers came apparently out of the west on the road that passes by the ancient resting area under the trees of Mamre, which eventually turns into the city of Hebron. And Abram, when he sees these strangers passing by in the middle of the day, immediately shows hospitality to them, inviting them to rest in the shade of the tree, and that he would get them some lunch and make sure that they could kick their sandals off and have their feet washed and just kind of snooze a little bit, you know, take a little nap while they're waiting for lunch to be prepared. And then once lunch is ready to go, there it is. They've got some good fresh roasted meat and some fresh baked bread, and there's some milk, and there's some soft cheese or curds that's ready to go for them. There might have been some vegetables, you know, maybe some onions, maybe some leeks, maybe some figs or dates or raisins or whatever. Several other items on the menu for them to enjoy. And so the last thing that we saw was in verse number 8, where Abram was standing by them there under the tree as they ate. And I said that he was basically acting as the maitre d' of this restaurant to see to their needs as they had their meal. So he is showing great hospitality here, great love of strangers. Verse number 9 of Genesis 18. They said to him, "Where is Sarah, your wife?" Now, I am not altogether certain whether or not Abraham would have been surprised that they mentioned her by name. It is possible that he had a conversation with them, that he mentioned her name, but not necessarily. In the customs of this time period and throughout much of the history of the Middle East, the ladies kind of hung back away from strangers that came into their tent community. It was kind of a stranger danger issue. You know, women were considered great values to the community, and you didn't want to take a chance that strangers might come in and grab them or harm them in some fashion. So they kind of hung out elsewhere when strangers were present. So this stranger, the spokesperson, says, "So, where is Sarah, your wife?" And Abraham said back to him, "Well, she's in the tent." So they're under the tree, outside the tent. "He who is said..." So now we find out, and this is Moses writing the story, so he's getting it straight from God's Holy Spirit, that one of the three is God in temporary flesh. Now, some people go, "This is Jesus." Maybe. Others go, "This is the Father." Maybe. I've never heard anyone say this was the Holy Spirit, but I'm going to say maybe to that as well. This is God in the flesh visiting Abraham and having eaten a meal there in his presence. And so God said to him, he who has said to him, I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, shall have a son. Now, this is where we find out that this little visit is happening only days, weeks at the most, after the circumcision ceremony of chapter number 17, when God had visited. It was during that event that God had told him the first time, next year, Sarah's going to have a baby boy, and you're going to give him the name Chuckles or Giggles or Snicker or Yitzhak, laughter. So here we have God identifying himself to Abraham clearly. I will be back right around this time year, next year, about 12 months out. And by that time, Sarah, your wife, will have a baby boy. So now Abraham knows this is God. Now, how shocking has that got to be? It's got to be very, very nerve-wracking to realize that God has taken on human form and come into your presence, which is exactly what the whole prologue of John chapter 1 is about, isn't it? That God became flesh and dwelt among us. Well, here is just a temporary taste of that. Now, Sarah, we're told at the end of verse 10, was listening at the tent door behind him. Now, does that surprise anyone? She's got visitors in her encampment, and she's curious, what are they talking about? What's the latest news, you know? And instead of some of the latest stories about the region, she hears her own name mentioned, and the fact that she's going to be pregnant and have a baby between now and 12 months from now. Verse 11. Now, Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in years. Now, how old? Well, Abraham, we know, is about 99, which means that Sarah is 90, because they're 9 years apart. And we're told here specifically the way of women had ceased to be with Sarah. Now, I actually mentioned this last time, but here it is very specifically. She is postmenopausal. She's not had her period for quite some time by now, probably several years. And it is impossible physically for her to have babies. So what does she do when she hears this person, because that's how he's presenting himself, say, Sarah's going to have a baby boy by this time next year? Verse 11, so Sarah laughed to herself. And it's the exact same word again that happened with Abraham. It's that catching in the throat sort of, I can't believe what I'm hearing. It's the snicker, it's the chortle, it is the chuckle. So she laughed to herself saying, after I'm worn out, meaning postmenopausal, and my Lord is old, well, he is pushing 100. Now, we know that he lives on to be 175. But during this time period, most people in this genetic family is living into the middle of their second century. So he is over middle age, and she knows that. So my Lord's old, so I'm worn out, my Lord is old, shall I have pleasure? Am I going to be able to have a baby at this point in life? So, verse 13, he who is said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh and say, shall I indeed bear a child now that I am old? So, he already knew that that was how she reacted and asks Abraham, why'd she laugh? Is anything too hard for he who is? See, is anything impossible? That comes into the story of Mary, doesn't it? Where the impossible happens in her life. She is a virgin, and she gives birth to a son who is the seed of Abraham. Continuing in verse 14, at the appointed time, I will return to you about this time next year, and Sarah shall have a son. Now, Sarah denied it. So she's inside the tent, she's eavesdropping, and apparently she can't help herself. She says, I didn't laugh through the tent flap. Okay? I didn't laugh, for she was afraid. So apparently it wasn't just in her heart. Apparently it escaped through her throat, through her lips, through her mouth and her nose. That little catch came out loud enough, she thinks, that the guest heard it. And that would be rather insulting. And so she's a little nervous about that. I didn't laugh, for she was afraid. And he said, no, but you did laugh. And I don't think God is mad at her. In fact, I think it's more of the reason why he says, you're going to name him Yitzhak. Because while you snickered at the idea, while you chortled at this idea, while you chuckled at this idea in derision, you can't believe it, I'm going to give you a reason to really laugh about it later because you'll be happy. And I love that about God, that he takes even our hesitance, takes our disbelief, and can make it better for us, bring something good out of it. It's the Romans 8:28 principle, that God can take anything, even the worst stuff, and somehow bring something good out of it for the benefit of his people. Now, verse 16. We get to the reason for this visit, because it really wasn't to let them know again about Yitzhak. Verse 16. Then the men set out from there, and they looked down toward Sodom. And Abraham went with them to set them on their way. Now, Hebron, the ancient site of Mamre, we know exactly where it's at. It's kind of down in a little valley between some hills, a little bowl, if you will. And when you go westward from there toward the Dead Sea Valley, you go up a little bit and a couple of miles later to the west, or excuse me, a couple of miles later to the east, you come high enough on the geography that you can look down into the Dead Sea Valley. Now, the Dead Sea Valley today, very dry and dead. But back at this time, it was very lush. Remember the whole story of Lot and Abraham separating. We're talking about the South Bay area of the Dead Sea. And this is probably where Sodom and Gomorrah and Admah and Zeboim and Bela were located, the five cities of the plain. We know where Bela is. It's the ancient city of Zoar, and we know where Zoar is located, there on the southeast corner of the South Bay of the Dead Sea. That's where they're heading, to the cities of the plain. And so Abraham walks with them up the hill and up and over the rise to kind of, you know, just chat with them a little bit longer before they go down into the plain of Siddim, that is the plain of cultivated fields, as it was called at this time. And he talks to them as they go. So a couple of miles, so they've got a good half hour or so that they can chat. Verse 17, He who is said, shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. So God goes back to the covenant relationship he has already with Abraham, that Abraham is going to become many people groups, very special people groups, and that the whole earth is going to be blessed through him. And this is a prophecy about Jesus. In his seed, Jesus, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. So Abraham has a very special place in the covenant story, in the salvation story. And so God says, should I keep from you something really important? And the answer is no, I don't plan on keeping it from you. Verse 19, for I have chosen him that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of he who is by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord, or he who is, may bring to Abraham what he has promised to him. Now, I don't want to skip over this verse. This is an important verse. God has chosen Abraham to be the anchor point of the faith. He is going to teach Isaac, and then Isaac is supposed to teach Jacob and Esau. And Jacob and Esau are supposed to teach all of their kids that there is one true God, that this God created us, that this God has a plan for us, and that this God is working out a way of salvation. Notice the word "the way" here. And the early Jewish church called themselves the way. And I think it goes all the way back to this passage. And it is the way of righteousness and justice. It is the way of holiness. It is the way of salvation and relationship. And so God is saying, I have picked you to start a movement that is really important. So why wouldn't I bring you in on a really big event? Verse number 20. Then he who is said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and their sin is very grave. Now we only have two of the five cities mentioned here, and it's just a shortcut. Don't want to repeat all five cities every single time we talk about them. So Sodom and Gomorrah were probably the two most prominent, maybe the most populous, of the five cities of the plain. Later, Lot will refer to Bela as being the little city. And so apparently they weren't all the same size, and that's why Bela gets saved and gets a new name, Zoar, which has the sense that it's a little city. It's an insignificant city. Now, when we talk about population, I think it's important that we realize that our sense of population is overblown in comparison to the ancient world. We live in a world of 8 billion plus people. And so numbers are big to us. But that's not always been the case. If you just go back 64 years to the year I was born, 1960, the world population was just over 2 billion. So we have increased by threefold just in my lifetime. You go back 100 years before I was born, back to the time of the Civil War, and there was barely a billion people living in the world. We know that the estimates going backward from there, in the time of Jesus, it was estimated that the world population was somewhere between 100 million and 300 million. Understand that that is less than the current population of the United States. That's all that we're in the entire globe, in the entire world. This story of Abraham is happening in 2000 BC. There is probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 million people only in the entire world. Now, how many of them were living in the Middle East, the place where Abraham is living? Well, there's no guaranteed way to know the answer to that. But here is a way that we can kind of work with in our own heads. Right now, there's about 15 million people living in the ancient promised land. 15 million, that's it. And so if you go backward in time and use the ratios of population in certain regions, then that would give us an estimate of something like 40,000, 45,000 people living in the entirety of the promised land. That's not very many people, is it? That's less people than live in, I think, Mishawaka, Osceola combined. It's not a lot of people scattered over the Middle East or scattered over the promised land. So these cities that we keep reading about here are probably only made up of several hundred adults and their kids. So Sodom and Gomorrah, Zeboim, Admah, and Bela, probably a couple of thousand people, few thousand people altogether. But they've been bad. They've been extraordinarily bad. They are the worst of the region. We talked about this from the book of Ezekiel when we were talking about when these five cities were overrun by the Mesopotamian armies, that they were full of themselves. They were rich. They were well, perhaps even overfed. And they only thought about themselves. They didn't care about anyone else. They most certainly didn't look after the poor that might have been near them. And so in a society that is so self-centered like that, so fat and happy, so fat and self-satisfied, they also get bored. And when you get bored, you start experimenting. And when you start experimenting, you start trying to cross lines. And so that is why this society has been engaging in all sorts of inappropriate sexual behavior and interaction with others. And so they are, well, they have become kind of a little pocket of what the world was like right before the flood. They're just super bad. The intentions of their heart from their youth upward and from the moment that they wake until the moment they go to sleep is all about themselves and how can I do something that pushes the boundaries of God's rules. That's what they're like. So that's what God is reacting to. Verse 20, then he who is said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great and their sin is very grave, I will go down and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry that has come to me. And if not, I'll know. Now, God doesn't have to go there physically to know this. He doesn't even have to send his angels there physically to know this, which is what he does, because only the two angels go down to Sodom. So why does he express it in this way? So that Abraham can relate to it. So that Abraham will understand that God thinks through his decisions and bases it on what people are doing. So the men turned from there, and they went towards Sodom. But Abraham still stood before He Who Is. And Abraham drew near and said, "Will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked?" Now, who's he thinking about? He's thinking about his nephew Lot, and his nephew's wife, and his nephew's two girls that are apparently close to marriageable age, but not yet married. So he's thinking about his family members. They're living in Sodom. Certainly, God is not going to wipe them out with all these other bad people. Verse 24, "Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you then sweep away the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous who are in it?" Now think, if there were 500 people in the city, then 50 would be, what, 10%. So if only 10% are righteous, would you still wipe it out? "Far be it from you to do such a thing, to put the righteous to death with the wicked, so that the righteous fare as the wicked. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just?" So he is pleading for mercy. Verse 26, "He who has said, 'If I find at Sodom 50 righteous in the city, I'll spare the whole place for their sake.' Abraham answered and said, 'Behold, I've undertaken to speak to the Lord, I who am but dust and ashes.'" And he knows this is God now. "Suppose 5 of the 50 righteous are lacking. Will you still destroy the whole city for lack of 5? He says, "I won't destroy it if I find 45 there." Again, he spoke to him and said, "Suppose only 40 are found." He said, "For the sake of 40, I won't do it." He said, "Oh, let the Lord not be angry. I'll speak. Suppose 30 are found." He said, "I'll not do it if I find 30 there." He said, "Behold, I have undertaken to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 are found there." And he answered, "For the sake of 20, I will not destroy it." And then he said, "Oh, no, let not the Lord be angry. I'll speak once again. Suppose 10 are found there." And he answered, "For the sake of 10, I will not destroy it."